Welcome to Lost River Legends. Our motto, Ex Tenebris, is Latin for out of the shadows. We attempt to understand the complex world around us and bring light to subjects hidden in darkness. We explore paranormal topics with guests from all around the world. Now welcome your Lost River Legends hosts, James and Brett. We hope you enjoy the show.
Latest episode of Lost River Legends. Thank you for listening to the podcast. In today's episode, our co-host James talks with Jim Myers. Jim is the owner of the Sasquatch Outpost, a museum that is all about Sasquatch. His Sasquatch Museum is listed as one of the top 10 wackiest places to visit in all of Colorado. Jim is the co-host of the popular You Don't Know Squatch podcast, which is all about Sasquatch. Jim has been interested and has researched the subject of Sasquatch for nearly 10 years. We wanted to thank Jim for being a guest on the show today. And with that being said, if anyone listening has ever had a Bigfoot or a Sasquatch encounter, we would love to hear your story. If you'd like to be on the show, you can reach us at show@LostRiverLegendsPodcast.com. Also, for those listeners listening on iTunes, if you could give us a 5-star rating and review, it really helps the show grow and helps others find the podcast. You can also find Lost River Legends on Facebook or Instagram. So if you have an extra minute, go ahead and search us there and give us a like and a follow. We would really appreciate it. And lastly, we just wanted to thank you for listening to the show and for supporting us. We really appreciate it. James and I both love what we do, and we're very passionate about giving you guys the best episodes possible. And with that being said, here's our latest episode.
All right, welcome to Lost River Legends. This is your host, James. I'm joined today by Jim Myers of the Sasquatch Outpost in or around Bailey, Colorado. And he's been gracious enough to join us. Our mutual friend, Paola Harris, referred him to me, and I'm very thankful to have you on the show. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You know, I was thinking about what kind of impetus or drive made you want to create the Sasquatch Outpost, and what's kind of the background behind that? Tell us a little bit about that.
That's a question I get asked a lot, because the store that houses the outpost and the museum was built in 1878. It was the original and only grocery store in Bailey. And actually, when it was built, it was the only grocery store anywhere in the foothills of the Rockies. And so it has a long history. When we took it over, it was not our intention initially to do what we're doing now. We took it over in 2012, and our plan was to make a grocery store / mercantile to kind of bring it back. It had been boarded up for 4 years, was shut up, and was in terrible condition. So it took us 9 months to rebuild it to where we could open it. And during those 9 months, two important things happened. Now, I've always been a Bigfoot believer, really ever since the legend of Boggy Creek came out in 1972. I was 10. It was a very scary movie at that time. Even though it was rated G, it scared everybody in the theater, most of us were kids. And yet, it made you wonder whether something like that could be out there. They never called it Bigfoot or Sasquatch. They called it the Boggy Creek Monster. I think even in the early 70s, the term Bigfoot or Sasquatch were not widely used yet. But so two things happened during those 9 months. I met my first Bigfoot eyewitness, who was a gal who lived here in Bailey. She was managing a lodge here. very credible businesswoman. And I heard about it, and I got together with her for coffee and asked her to tell me her story, because I had never talked to anyone who'd actually seen a Bigfoot. She told me her story. It was very believable, and she was with her best friend, so both of them saw this Sasquatch. So I didn't doubt that they had seen it, and in fact, I wanted it to be true. I wanted Bigfoot to be a real thing, not a legend. And then maybe a month or a month and a half later, Finding Bigfoot came to Bailey to do an episode, in part because of her testimony, but in part other people that have had things happen here. So I went to that town hall meeting and heard quite a few testimonies. And we'd already started to lean towards, which is what we ended up doing, calling our store the Bailey Country Store, which is what it had been for a long time, many, many, many years. The Bailey Country Store and Sasquatch Outpost. And within 2 years, we realized groceries were not going to make it. We were going to starve to death. So we made a hard decision. But in the meantime, as the groceries were waning, we had started this little room in the back of the store that was a storage room, which is now the museum. And we put a map on the wall of Colorado, and people started coming in and started telling us stories. And once the word started getting out, they really started pouring in. So we realized it's a risk, but this seems to be a calculated risk because of the interest that we found. And boy, it just took off. We dropped the country store name and just kept Sasquatch Outpost, and we've never looked back. I mean, the store has grown by like 15 or 20% a year ever since we opened. And it hasn't slowed down. So that just shows the interest that there is in this topic.
Well, that's fascinating too, because it was just kind of not your intention. And then this organically just kind of started coming about.
Yep.
That's awesome. It makes sense when something comes up like that to kind of grasp that and with both hands and hold it close. So that's awesome that you've been able to build that up. And you're still selling groceries there.
We are not. We are uniquely a Bigfoot souvenir store, the gift store for the museum. And it's a good sized store, and we've probably got well over 1,000 different items we sell, from t-shirts to mugs to stickers to you name it. If it's got Bigfoot on it, if it doesn't, we'll put it on it. And so we get people coming from all over the country who may not be interested in the topic or the museum, but they want to buy funny Bigfoot souvenirs. So we definitely meet that demand in the store.
And that makes sense. I mean, there's that pop culture angle to Sasquatch. I know the Archie McPhee brand always has a new Sasquatch thing. I mean,
we do sell some of their stuff.
For my birthday, I got a little Sasquatch. It's about 2 inches high. You can throw it in a tub and it'll turn into a
growth watch. Yeah.
That's just ridiculous.
Yeah. We've sold a lot of those too.
It's pretty funny. Pretty funny concept. But yeah, I would imagine lots of stickers getting sold. We see those all over.
We sell
trucks.
Probably more stickers than t-shirts between the two is what we sell the most of. But we try to make a big differentiation between the store, which is fun and tongue-in-cheek, and we're making fun of ourselves and Bigfoot. And then when you step into the museum, we intentionally created a very different tone, because we don't want people to assume fun at the topic. We're not. We're trying to educate people on what we believe is a very real, legitimate issue that they need to know about. And so, you know, I try to make that line of store to museum a very clear one, that we're not playing anymore. When you come in the museum, this is education.
I think that's a really clear distinction that's important to have, because it is kind of the two different things. And, you know, along with that, the reality of Sasquatch as a living creature, Kind of what stands out most to you as a critical piece of supporting evidence to its existence?
Oh, sightings for one. I mean, I don't even know how many there are. It's a shame that all the different Bigfoot organizations can't get together and count well over 60,000 sightings, probably three or four times that many, if you add in all the people who've never talked to anybody about what happened. But just in our store, on our map, we've got pins that denote a visual sighting and something like a vocalization, auditory, or a knock, something that was thrown at them, or footprints that they found that they thought were Sasquatch. All those four pins combined, I think we have 330 pins on the map. And most of those people have never talked to anybody about this before. So that alone, that's what convinced my wife. She was a skeptic. After eyewitness 10, 20, 30 came in, all very bright, very normal people, doctors, cops, you know, whatever. And Daphne finally says to me one day, these people can't all be lying, and they can't all have mistaken a bear for something else. So there has to be something to this. So it was all those testimonies that convinced her. For me, the best evidence is obviously see a Sasquatch and you'll forever be a believer. But assuming someone never did see one, the best evidence is the numbers of footprints that have been cast around the country into many thousands of footprints, for one, all over the country. And probably the Native American element. By that I mean the fact that so far every Native American tribe I have talked to has their own tradition, their own name, their own oral tradition of Sasquatch. Everyone in that tribe believes in them. And I've talked to lots of Navajo, Lakota Sioux, Utes, all of them believe they all have different name for Sasquatch. So if you look at that across the country, how can all these Native American tribes have the same tradition about the same kind of creature and it be false? There's no way.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, the natives have been here a lot longer than things have been settled, and that could go, you know, we're talking, we don't know how many thousands of years of history.
Don't know.
The lay of the land could have changed a little bit, but as far as interacting or having those encounters back then, I'm sure that's kind of what some of those legends and some of those traditions come out of, you know, like,
yeah,
we need to tell this information to pass it down because it's important to have. So that's certainly ingrained.
Yeah. And they believe they're people. They're not animals. They call them people. They call them the forest tribe or the hairy tribe, but they're not animals to Native Americans. So they're definitely different than us. They're a different kind of people, but they're people. And I think that's very significant as well. It's the non-educated people who want to believe that Sasquatch is purely just an animal, a brute, gorilla, America's great ape, whatever. It's just not the case.
Yeah, there's certainly some signs of intelligence. I know that there's been some, for lack of a better term, like the way that they can build shapes out of, mm-hmm. you know, out of rocks and twigs and things like that. I mean, there's obviously the tree leanings and things like that, and that's kind of another area that we could get into. I did want to kind of rewind a little bit, and you said that you had a bunch of experiences being shared with you. Is there any of those that you feel comfortable sharing that you'd like to share with us?
Oh, hundreds. Our own experiences and many other people's. An experience I had recently, probably within the last 3 weeks, I've had several this summer, but I was camping with a couple of guys. I started sleeping in a hammock instead of a tent. And it's a hammock that has a insect net incorporated into it, kind of a lie flat hammock. But I do that intentionally, even though it's scarier. It's making myself vulnerable and hopefully more interesting for them to come. And so I've probably slept in a hammock 4 or 5 times now. This last time, it was kind of rainy. The other two guys were in a tent. And so I put the rainfly over the hammock, and it makes it like it's a cocoon or a burrito. I'm inside this burrito. And I'm hoping Sasquatch doesn't see me as a burrito, but I can't see anything. I'm totally encapsulated in this rainfly. So, and I had a military poncho hung over that because it hung down farther on the sides, and I had my gear underneath, so it was more protection from the rain. And I kind of tied my poncho hoodie to a branch above the tent, or above the hammock, and to kind of hold it in place. So sometime during the night, I woke up, turned on a little dome light. I was checking, trying to figure out where my phone was. It was in the hammock somewhere, so I'm feeling around for it. And all of a sudden, something slapped the top of the hammock from above and then pulled that poncho off. And so I'm lying there waiting to see what happens next, looking inside. All I can see is inside, waiting for, you know, a big hand to come pushing down again. It didn't. I turned off the light. To my knowledge, nothing else happened that evening, but it was interesting that maybe it was the light that bothered or whatever, but it was clearly near the hammock. I don't know how long it had been there or how long it stayed, but yeah, that was typical of what happened. Had I had the cover off, I would have seen whatever it was if it chose to come when I could see it. But lots and lots of encounters. Trying to think of some more recent ones. Several research friends have had numerous encounters, bizarre encounters. The longer you do this, the more bizarre things happen that send you down the rabbit hole and you just never come out because it just keeps going down and down and down. But had several friends have witnessed them disappear in front of their eyes while they're watching them, whether with their eyes or through binoculars, and it just dematerializes and disappears. And we don't know where they go. We don't know what, if they're just going invisible to our vision, but they definitely go invisible. And so, which introduces lots of aspects about them that we don't understand, maybe never will. But another researcher friend of mine was in his tent. He was part of a big BFRO expedition, maybe 50, 60 people. And I'm not in favor of those gigantic expeditions personally, but he was on the edge in his tent. He has a big outfitter tent. You can stand up in its canvas. I've been in there with him before when they've messed with us. And he was asleep. He said about 2:30, he heard something walk right up to the tent. Usually they'll try and be stealthy and you might hear footsteps. You might not. This one was just thud, 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 thud right up to the tent and started poking the tent above his head from outside, just messing with the tent. Then it pushed its hand in, you know, kind of pushing in on the tent, found his head on the cot and pushed down on his head into the cot, not violently or to hurt him in any way, but just pushed down and then let up. And I said, what were you thinking when that hand was pushing on your face? He said, I was hoping it didn't pop my head. And because that was his first physical contact in 14 years as a researcher. Then it reached down and it grabbed his bed through the tent, picked it up, held it for a minute, dropped it back down. And then it reached up on the supporting pole up in the middle of the tent and started tapping it with his fingernail. And you know, that kind of interaction is more rare, but it's not uncommon that we get poked at or tents messed with in the night. We were out hiking. Go ahead.
Sorry, that alludes to just like pure curiosity to me. Like that just seems like, what is this thing? You know, who is here? Kind of we're in their backyard, not the other way around.
We are. So they know we're there. We're never going to sneak up on them. Rather, we try to make as much noise as possible so that they come close to us into the camp at night. And if you're not camping, it's a little harder, but it's not uncommon that they'll follow us in the woods where we can't see on either side, one side or the other or both. We'll hear cracking of branches as we're walking up a trail. So we'll stop to listen. Of course, they stop. They always do that. It's very annoying. Then you start walking again when you can't hear as much and you hear the cracking on both sides again. And so it's not that common that they'll step out, but they definitely follow you and they want to know what you're up to in their woods, in their house, basically.
Yeah, there's some commonality there on some behavior levels. Have you ever been paced out? I know that that's pretty common in more of some of the aggressive encounters where there's some territorial male or something going on. Have you or anyone you know ever been paced out and kind of that same parallel, like you're being escorted out of the area, so to speak.
No, I've been followed, but not in a way that was pushing me in any direction. They were just following. And I know that on a couple of occasions, because I could see their eye shine and I could see that as I was leaving, they were at the top of the hill where I had just been watching me leave. And so they weren't moving towards me. But it's not uncommon that they would accompany us out of the forest and even then show up at our house. That's researchers have talked about this a lot, where if they're out in the woods a lot, eventually Sasquatch comes to where they live and leaves footprints or gives some kind of a sign, slaps their house, whatever. But as far as I've never even really had an aggressive vocalization. And they've thrown stuff at us more than once, or hit trees with a stick or with a rock to make a loud noise, or throw green pine cones at us, things like that, which I do not interpret as aggression. Many people misinterpret what Sasquatch's intentions are, and they assume, even if they just see the Sasquatch, it never does anything, never moves towards them, never shows any aggression. Just seeing it is enough to cause people never to go back in the woods again, even though it didn't show any aggression. And so when they're vocalizing, or, you know, people will say to me, well, they wanted me out of the woods because they were just screaming. And my response is, well, how do you know they were screaming at you? Maybe they were screaming at something else. And how do you know that scream means I want you out? What if the scream means I'm here, I know you're here, it's cool, you know? So, but I think I've never had bluff charges, things like that, which would definitely tell you that they don't want you there, because they come charging through the woods, breaking stuff, and for all the world sound like they're going to knock you flat when they get to you. And then they stop before they, like a gorilla has, you know, the gorilla's behavior of bluff charging and making you move, get out. But I've never had any of that. I've had quite a few vocalizations, had them around my campsite many times, but never had them do anything that I would interpret as aggressive or as that they didn't want me in their area. Rather, we've exchanged a lot of gifts with them, and they seem to enjoy us being there, and they'll mess with the stuff we left, or they'll take stuff and bring their own re-gifting, things like that. So no, I know people have had what they would call aggressive encounters, I think aggression is in the eye of the experiencer. So I can't say it was aggressive or wasn't. I just know I've never had to be aggressive to me, even though I was scared. And I could have interpreted something as aggression, but I don't think it was. I think it's just their normal behavior.
I think that's a really good point. I think there is something about your angle of approach too. And we've talked about this on our show a little bit, and this bleeds over into some other areas, but your intent going, you know,
right.
When you go into the woods, you have a peaceful intent. You're meaning to have some kind of takeaway as far as a contact goes, or outreach, to have some kind of, for lack of a better word, communication.
Right.
So it's different in its intent than, you know, not expecting an encounter. An encounter happens, and then kind of fight or flight kicks in,
and we run away. Yeah. Whether we're being chased or not, we run away because they're big and hairy and scary from the outside. And so most people would never stick around to see what might have happened in that encounter had they not moved away. So
do you think,
or the Sasquatch moves away, either one, sometimes both
true,
happen.
True. Yeah. Just pivots and goes the other way.
Right.
So do you think that there's something to either a genetic memory or a collective consciousness psyche of what our impression of that is, of that kind of primal fear?
From our side, you mean, or what?
Yeah, sorry, I didn't really word that very well. So, on the human side, interacting, you know, mm-hmm. if there's some kind of like, I don't know if collective consciousness is the best term, but like something ingrained in us, that says kind of beware or has that fear response.
I think so. I think, well, based on responses of people who've had close encounters, and because Sasquatch is, you know, as a child, most of us grew up being afraid of monsters under our bed, in our closet. And what we imagine those monsters looking like is probably not far from what a Sasquatch actually looks like. And so big, hairy, muscular, intimidating. So it's normal when somebody sees one, I think it's a normal human reaction to be afraid and to want to move away. That's probably not what the Sasquatch is intending in that encounter, but that's our, as you said, kind of our primal response that, oh my God, what is that? I've got to get out of here. And because in many respects, we are defenseless, even if we're carrying a weapon, the chance that we're going to be able to kill a Bigfoot are slim. We would probably succeed in pissing it off more than anything. Then we're really in trouble. Because if there is ever violence against humans, I think it's provoked in some way by being attacked, in their mind, being attacked from our side. And I don't have any doubts that they see us as a threat, particularly men. They don't seem to mind women and children as much. They'll come close to women and children. They'll watch them as they play, as they work. Men, I think, comprise a bigger risk to them than women or children do. So they're not as keen sometimes to show themselves to us as they would be to females or children. Because they have their own, what's the term, survival instinct or whatever. They're not going to intentionally put themselves at risk or in any of their group at risk unnecessarily. And so, I think that's a normal human reaction to something we do not understand and something that looks scary. Just by their physical appearance. And so that's a normal response. It's harder to have a response where you don't react and that you actually try to engage with the Sasquatch. It would take a great deal of self-control. And I've not had a very close encounter. I've had a an encounter at a distance, but not close enough that I felt like, it couldn't have got me. It was up on the side of a hill looking down. It was too far, too difficult to get to me. But if I was 10 feet away, I'd probably feel very different, you know, because they can clear that one stride. So I hope I'll have that close encounter where I can see them. I know I've had many close encounters where they've been near me, they've shown me that, but I've never physically seen them close up.
Yeah, maybe it's something you're working up to, or is that intention coming through or something? I'm not sure.
Intentions are very important. I think they sense it on their side. So getting your intent straight before you go into the woods is often not a bad thing, where you just stop, kind of meditate a little bit about what you're hoping for as you go into the woods, and try to communicate to them telepathically, if you like. Maybe that's not the right term, but communicate your intentions to them. Intentions, they seem to be able to pick up on that. They seem to have a good grasp of when we're there to learn and grow, or when we're there to see them so we can get a picture, so we can sell for $1 million. And, you know, that's a very different intent on the heart that I think is probably able to be sensed by a creature as intelligent and as intuitive as Sasquatch seems to be.
You know, you make a valid point there about that, and about maybe they're on a different rhythm, or there's something electromagnetically that they can, like you said, your heart, you know, our hearts are electromagnetic, right? But it's interesting how we know now that there's a connection from that to our brain, and, you know, from our gut to our brain. So, you know, we're always learning kind of more even about ourselves, and who are we to say that they can or can't do something like that?
Exactly. I agree.
So something else I was thinking about was, you talked about, you know, when you're a kid, what you're afraid of, and you have a little bit different upbringing as far as your background, where you lived and what you were surrounded by. How does that play into how you kind of look at the subject?
Well, I grew up in Africa to missionary parents, but I had the same fears as any kid of monsters under my bed. You know, I would, up until, I don't know how old I was, 10, 11 years old, probably, I would never just get out of my bed. I would jump out of my bed to get beyond the reach of the monsters that lived under my bed from grabbing me. And, you know, you imagine them being, in my mind, being scary, hairy, whatever, or living in my closet or whatever. But I've always been afraid of the dark, even as a little child. And so that's something I've had to overcome, to be out in the woods a lot at night, is the fear that there's things out there I can't see and I'm vulnerable. They have all the advantages. I am at a disadvantage when I'm out here in the woods. They know where I am. I don't know where they are. And so they, if they should choose to have the advantage to hurt me, kill me, whatever, they don't, but that fear is still there. And it's gotten less over the years. I realize how much my perspective has changed when I take people out who've never been out at night, and they're just filled with fear, you know, what's going to happen, and is Bigfoot going to grab us? And they're, you know, it's almost self-defeating to go out when you have that in your mind, because it's like, I'm so afraid, I'm not even going to notice anything that happens around me, because I'm looking around for whatever's going to come kill me. And you have to get past that. You have to get to a place where you're at peace with what we think they are, and who they see us as, and that their intent is not to abduct us and carry us off and eat us. They're going to interact, but that interaction is out of curiosity, and that they want to know about us just like we want to know about them. So, you have to get past the immobilizing fear to a place where you can be in the woods and be at peace and trust that they're not going to hurt you.
Yeah, I know that takes a little bit of work. That takes a little bit of
It takes time.
Yeah.
And not being hurt and realizing none of your friends who do this are hurt, and it's just statistics would say the probability is infinitesimally small that a Sasquatch is going to hurt you when you're in the woods. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, yeah, and I think we like to kind of have some things play out in our head, or what we think is, you know, going on.
Right.
My co-host Brett and I, we camped up in some pretty rugged mountains up in central Idaho here in the last couple years. And, you know, the place we were at was kind of spooky. There was not any other wildlife really. I think maybe a chipmunk. Like it was pretty stark. So, you know, when it came to nighttime, I'm in the hammock burrito like you were, and, you know, it's kind of the same setup. I was not too comfortable, but
have you ever been poked, to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge. I do have memory of, and this could be attributed to a grizzly bear. I didn't have a visual sighting or anything, but in scouts, we were up kind of towards, we're on the Idaho side of the Tetons, in that area, in the Jedediah Smith Wilderness. It's pretty thick through there, and grizzlies are known to come into camp. But the footsteps that I heard were very heavy footfalls, and there was kind of some sniffing and walking around the tent. I always attributed it to a bear. I don't know, you know, but my grandfather has a story. It's actually Brett and I both have the same grandfather. So, you know, there's a story of a bear urinating on a tent, and some of me wonders if that was a Sasquatch, you know?
Yeah. I mean, how do they know it was a bear urinating on the tent? I mean, I've heard of Sasquatch urinating on tents. I've never heard of a bear doing that. I mean, I suppose they could, but they have to be willing to come that close to us inside the tent. And bears have a healthy fear of us. So they may come into the camp to eat something, but they don't tend to just stick around and hang around your tent because they know that sooner or later you're going to come out, and they don't want that. So, but I have friends that have had them pee on their tents. It sounded like a Niagara Falls. He said it was just incredibly powerful.
Interesting.
That's or trenched the ground next to the tent. I mean, 2 inches deep. From the force of their urine. I mean, that's just, I don't know many people that could do that. You know, I don't care.
Yeah, that's something.
How good your prostate is. I mean, being able to force, I mean, these things, it's just unbelievable. And he said it would literally made a ditch in the ground. Yeah,
certainly.
Bears, I've never heard of doing that.
Yeah, certainly.
Something they couldn't, but I've never heard.
Something other than what we're used
other,
to for sure.
Yes.
Yeah, I other. Kind of put that in that realm. Let's see. You have a close working relationship with Dave Pilates, and I wanted to discuss kind of his approach angle and kind of what helps you. I think that's something we ascribe to pretty closely with the Hoopa project and some of the evidences that are presented there. And, we did talk a little bit earlier about, the native histories and things like that, but if you want to speak to that, that'd be good.
Yeah. Dave and I have known each other for probably 10 years, something like that. And we've been out in the woods together numerous times, and we've organized conferences together. Dave is a, how would I put it? You know, the Bigfoot community is divided between along a number of lines, but probably the easiest way to describe the difference is those who believe that Sasquatch is an ape or a descendant of Gigantopithecus, or it's a new great ape, versus those who would say, and so therefore on that side, it would be purely physical, you know, they live and breathe like we do. They die, but 100% physical. And the other side is those who would say, like myself, well, I don't think they're an ape. I think they're more people. I think their DNA actually demonstrates that they're partially human. And that explains why they behave like humans do. They walk like us. They talk like us. They have families like ours. So Dave is kind of in the middle, although he's experienced a number of weird things related to Bigfoot that he can't explain that are in the paranormal realm. So he's become more open to that over the years. He's definitely not in the ape camp. And so we would both say they're highly intelligent hominids that in some way, shape, or form are related to us, and that much of their behavior can be explained as a break off of Homo sapiens in some way. I don't know what we would categorize them as. And I don't know when that mix of Homo sapiens with something else happened with the result that we have what we now know as Sasquatch. But Dave believes in Bigfoot. There's no question, believes that there's a lot about them that's human. He never wants to pull Bigfoot into his missing 411 books, which is why he wrote Tribal Bigfoot and the Hooper Project, because he did have a lot to say about Sasquatch, but he wanted to make it very defined as this is what I'm writing about Bigfoot. All the rest of this, the Missing 411 series, is just talking about people that have gone missing. He's not trying to tie those two worlds together to say that Bigfoot abducts all these people who are gone. He doesn't know. Nobody knows what happens to them. That's the whole point of being a missing 411 statistic, is nobody knows what happened to you. There's some evidence maybe, but I don't think we've yet come across a case, or Dave has yet come across a case, where he would say this person was 100% killed by a Bigfoot or abducted by a Bigfoot. You just can't say it. It's never happened. There's been no proof that beyond a shadow of a doubt that's what happened. So so he's in the Bigfoot world, but he's asked far more to speak about missing people than he is to speak about his beliefs about Bigfoot.
Yeah, and I understand that he leaves that open-ended for a reason, and mm-hmm. does have that distinction, and is not, you know, he's not purposely saying, you know, A plus B equals C.
No,
on this,
not
that's,
at all.
That's certainly not how
Bigfoot's only one of the options as to why people disappear. There's many other options too. So, many other explanations potentially.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, we spoke with Joshua Cutchin. I'm not sure if you're familiar.
Don't
with
know
him. So he's written a whole book on just, you know, smells surrounding paranormal encounters, including Bigfoot. And so he gets pretty granular, but he's great at examining the data. And some of the things that we were talking about was like, well, you know, we like to have, you know, there's this good and evil, and then there's like this other, like, we just don't know. There's this area where we really don't know.
Yeah. And I hope we are always big enough to say, we don't know. I don't get this. I don't know what this means. Because a lot of people will tell you they know and they understand why Sasquatch does this or this or this. I don't know how you could know that unless you speak Sasquatch and you sat down and talked with them and asked them. But yeah, there's a lot about these creatures, these beings that's a mystery to us. We see what they do. We don't understand why they do what they do. And they're not stopping to explain to us, well, this is what this means, and this is what this means. And it's just doesn't happen. doesn't mean that people who are more sensitive emotionally can't communicate. I think they do communicate with Bigfoot at a level that most people don't, at some kind of a extrasensory perception level. But Sasquatch is very complex. The more I learn, the less I know. Honestly, that's the honest truth about them.
Yeah, certainly. And we talked a little bit before we got on about how we really our minds like to put things in boxes, you know, and that's not really a good approach to this. We've kind of got to put our ego aside and be able to say, you know, I don't know, but you know, I'm open. Mm-hmm. I'm open. And you know, I kind of did that before. I used to have kind of a box, and that box kept getting broken and broken and broken over and over again. You know, Les Stroud's interview about his experiences, and I would think that he's a pretty credible person as far as his background. Mm-hmm. And his backwoods experience. He's probably, you know, right up there as far as his capability to stay sane in those situations.
And, yeah.
So as far as that goes, I think that adds a, you know, kind of a heavy weight to that side of there being, again, something other going on when it comes to, you know, what someone might call mind speak or telepathy.
Right.
You know, I'm not afraid to say that that's entirely a possibility. I think that, I spoke to someone about some of the prehistory of the Earth, and they had an opinion, and I don't know what it stems from, but they're a pretty well-studied person, and they said they thought humans were actually telepathic before they could speak. And that, you know, if there's some kind of relation there, you know, maybe they kept it, and we, you know, we evolved into...
We lost it.
Yeah, we departed from it or something like that, so... There's maybe something there to that. Well, I wanted to thank you for being able to take some time out today to join us. And, I think I've covered a vast amount of questions. I want to give you an opportunity to plug you have yourself a podcast and mm-hmm. a website and things like that. I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk about those and how people can reach out to you.
So SasquatchOutpost.com is our website, and on there is our online store. There's also a section about the museum. There's a section about our research. There's a lot on there, actually. If you go through the different headings on the website, the store and museum are physically located in Bailey, Colorado, a little town on Highway 285 coming out of Denver. And so we started a podcast a couple of years ago. It's called You Don't Know Squatch, and you can find it on YouTube, on Google Play, I think on Apple Play. But we talk a lot about, obviously Bigfoot is our main theme of that podcast, but we talk about a lot of aspects of Sasquatch, including our research, interviewing eyewitnesses, but talking about what's going on in the news with Sasquatch and what do we think about that. And we evaluate Bigfoot movies and like to talk about what we think is convincing or not in these movies, et cetera. So we do a lot of different things. But we're having a lot of fun with that. And we took a break this summer because we're working on another project of a movie that we want to make ourselves, but the podcast will be season 3, which should be starting to be uploaded within the next month or so.
Awesome. Well, I know I'm going to subscribe to that and add you to my list, because I've got about 20 podcasts I bounce around between, but certainly on this subject, there's only really a few. So, thank you so much for coming on today. And
you're welcome.
I want to make sure that our listeners, know that we haven't given up on the Bigfoot subject. We've got plenty more in store. There's always something new to learn and different experiences. So we can't thank you enough for being here today.
You're welcome. I appreciate being invited to join you guys.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Lost River Legends. If you enjoyed this episode and you would like to help support the podcast, please share it with others and consider subscribing. Here at Lost River Legends, our primary focus is delivering unique topics, amazing guests, all paired with top-notch production value. The Earth we live on has many hidden secrets, countless paranormal stories, and is filled with amazing, curious humans who are trying to find answers to life's questions. Here at Lost River Legends, we are no different. We believe an active curiosity to the unknown is ingrained in the human experience. We hope you will join us on our journey to explore the lost legends of the Earth by listening to past and future episodes. Until then, James and I wish you health, happiness, and a curious mind. And remember, the clock of life is ticking away. Don't waste another moment and live your best life.